Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPR 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome to the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and today it's a thriller show, so we've got like two thrillers from Manila. We've got Joe Goldberg. It's been a while.
It has been a while. It has been a while. I'm happy to hear that your dulcet tones of your voice, Al. It puts me to sleep. You're like an Ambien.
Yeah, I am. I'm the Ambien of the radio world. That's something to be proud of, I'll tell you. See, they pick on me all the time. And Gavin Stone from the UK is here. And look out, he's raring to go.
Hey, yeah, I'm tonight's decoy.
Okay. And you're ready for the turkey. It's almost Thanksgiving. You know, we almost recorded this on Thanksgiving. I didn't realize I set it up that way till Joe told me. And I don't know, I'm falling apart here. Getting old.
Yeah. Because you're not in the American Thanksgiving world, right?
No, not anymore. I haven't done American Thanksgiving for... Well, it's only been about 4 or 5 years, I think. Maybe 4 years. Yeah, 4 years.
So you forgot.
Yeah, I've kind of forgot. I was running both for a year or two, and then I just got too tired. They're too close to each other, and I get too turkeyed out, you know.
Yes.
Too much work. Well, now joining us, we've got, what can I say? She's a thriller author. The book is called The Peacock and the Sparrow, and it's a novel. So I.S. Barry, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, Ilana, how did you get into this world? Like, what would make you want to get into this writing world?
Well, I was a spy before I was a spy novelist. So I think my years as a spy kind of stayed with me. And they just didn't leave me. And I think writing this book was sort of my way of processing it. For me, it was sort of a dark profession because you're manipulating people all the time and they're manipulating you. And you make these decisions that have consequences on people's lives in a world where, you know, there's no clear right and wrong. And it really haunted me even to this day. So I think in a lot of ways that was sort of the impetus for writing my book. I know Joe was in the CIA too, so I think he can probably relate to some of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's still manipulating people with this.
That's true.
I thought you were
going to say, I manipulate that turkey, not to burn it. Yeah, burn my brisket. Yeah, well, no, but you're right. Because I remember coming out, and I was just sat there for a long time and just looked, stared at the wall and felt like, you know, days after day, you know, everything you did was like this Vaseline, sticky, slow feel. You know, never quite feeling comfortable and relaxed.
Yeah.
And I liked that the writing thing was your... method to get out of it. It ended up being mine, took a while, but I did some before, but did you do any of the writing while you were there at all to sort of offset it, to give it?
Not really, and I was undercover at the time.
Yeah.
For most of it. And I wrote my book is set in Bahrain, which I lived in after I left the agency during the Arab Spring, and it was for my husband's job. So to me, when I got to Bahrain, it was during the Arab Spring, and it was such an interesting conflict. There was no clear right side. You had the Saudis backing the monarchy and Iran back to some degree backing the revolutionaries. And it was just a perfect prism for a spy novel, in my view. So even though I hadn't served there as a CIA spy, that was sort of the perfect setting for me. So to answer your question, I was long out of the agency by the time I started writing the book. But I did write, I spent a year in Baghdad during the war from 2004 to 2005, which was pretty horrifying, pretty awful and traumatic. And I did kind of feel the need to write a lot of that stuff down after I left the agency. I kind of subscribe to Tim O'Brien, who wrote, he writes a lot of war literature. He wrote The Things They Carried. And he said something like, fiction is the lie that helps us understand the truth. Or he has some great quotes like that. And for me, I felt like, because I had written some sort of nonfiction pieces about my time in Baghdad, but I felt like at the end of the day, fiction proved to be sort of the best medium for me for kind of making sense of my experiences.
And it's also better to get through publications review.
100%. I agree with you on that.
Yep.
Yeah, I'd had more trouble getting my nonfiction pieces through. And I think this book went through with like a breeze. I mean, it had minimal redactions. Joe, what's your experience with the publications review board?
They do it. I give them credit for timing. They do it when they say they're going to do it, a month or 2 months. I love that. And the further away I've gotten from agency life, the first book had some, the second book had a few, third, fourth book basically done. I know less. I'm further away from knowing anything.
Right.
And there's been a lot more writers. So the stuff that I thought, oh my God, how could they possibly put that in a book? Is kind of like, yeah, that's on TV. No big deal.
Exactly. Well, not only a lot of writers, but a lot of really senior people, like a lot of directors have written memoirs. And I think when you have kind of the big wigs who are finally, writing and telling their stories, then you kind of the agency has to, be more egalitarian. And I just think that in general, that the agency has become more reasonable over the years. I think I was there at an unusual time. I mean, I was there not long after 9/11, and the agency was sort of recalibrating and kind of soul searching and a little bit more, I think, paranoid and insecure because we'd had this big intelligence failure, 9/11, and they were trying to shift operations from traditional, almost Cold War type operations to counter-terrorist. And, it was an agency that that was in flux. And I think for that reason, they were a little bit more paranoid. And I think that trickled down to publication review for several years as well.
Yeah. When you were writing and thinking about the story in the Arab Spring story and the Bahrain story, how much of it did you incorporate into your characters to make them around characters? Because you were already out, right?
Yeah.
So you were making people up in your head. How much of that did you use?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. and it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Used to create the character arcs themselves. The story, the plot, fine, got it. But the character arcs, how about that?
Well, I mean, so my main character, Shane Collins, is kind of, I would say, an amalgam of a lot of people I knew and worked with. And the only character who's really based directly on someone is the young, sort of unctuous station chief. And I think we've all known that type.
Gotta love him. Every station chief was a dream.
Right? I mean, in law school, we called them gunners, which were the kids, like, at the front of the class raising their hands, like, gunning to answer the question. So he was the only one that was based directly on, I'd say, a real person. But a lot of the expat characters were based on actual people. I was very much part of the expat community in Bahrain for 2 years. So it was really based on people I knew. And actually some of the dialogue was verbatim dialogue that I heard when I was over there. I mean, I just couldn't come up with better dialogue on my own. Just this sort of hedonistic insular bubble of expats, which I think you see again and again in foreign countries. And you saw it in Bahrain. And it was, and some of the things they would say were just incredible. You know, one woman saying, oh, you can wear anything that you want in this country, which of course you can't, but she meant that you can wear luxury goods. And it was just this sort of this very privileged attitude.
Well, it's an interesting thought, you know. It sounds like you are glad to be out of the agency, and you speak of the agency almost like a person. Like a character, like a single person.
Oh.
Is that how you see it?
No, I mean, I am glad that I'm out because I think it is it's a heavy career. It's not great for family life. But I'm really proud of my service. I do think I was there at kind of not the best time for the agency. And I do think it's gotten a lot better. I kind of saw the agency, I don't want to say it's worse, but certainly not at its best. And I think, but my view, you know, over time is that I think it's a really noble organization that does great work. And I do think that, I do think it's variegated. I don't view it as monolithic. And I think that there are good and bad people in the agency, just like in any organization. So no, I knew great people even when I was there. And what's really blown me away is since my book has come out, the agency community, both current and former, have just been so incredibly supportive. I mean, in a way that I never thought possible, but I've just been blown away by it. The agency has an internal creative writing group called Invisible Ink. And they reached out to me and had me come and speak at the agency. It was the first time I'd gone back in the building in, you know, 15 years. And I was so flattered and honored. And I feel like I'm so grateful for their support.
Yeah, I got a note saying, please don't ever show up.
Yeah.
Stay away.
Stay away. They give him the wrong address.
Yeah.
Well, it's weird. I mean, it's weird to be back. Like, the building had totally changed. Everything was more modern. I mean, when I was there, they had just put in, when I left, not long before I left, they put in the Dunkin' Donuts, which was like so exciting.
Dunkin' Donuts
and a Starbucks. Those were like the two big
things. Oh,
yeah. And let me tell you, so when the Dunkin' Donuts opened, I mean, man, that thing had a line for like 2 hours every morning for like a year. And the rumor was that like the director wanted to get rid of it, or a subsequent director wanted to get rid of it because it was just a big time suckage for all employees.
See, when Joe was first there, they just put in flush toilets. So
yeah, yeah. The dinosaurs were still roaming.
Electricity.
Yeah. So, you know, Dunkin' Donuts. Wow, that's luxury.
I mean, it was a big deal. Yeah.
Working in intelligence can be an exceptionally highly stressful job. When you did your writing, did you find that in a way therapeutic?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, I think, especially coming back from Baghdad, I mean, I think I probably had PTSD, as I think almost everyone who's in war does. I don't know anyone who doesn't have some degree of it. And it was really rough for me for about a year. And I mean, I would get panic attacks and loud noises would startle me. And there was one operation in particular in Baghdad that, really kind of haunted me. And I've written about this, the agency has cleared this. But basically I helped through my informant to apprehend an alleged top 10 terrorist target who was accused of participating in the 2003 bombing of UN headquarters in Baghdad. And through my informant, we were able to track this guy down. We brought him in for questioning and the military detained him. He didn't confess. But I thought for sure, you know, eventually the truth would come out, and I felt like I'd done my job, and I felt like this was a huge victory. I mean, it was, in 2004, 2005, we were not really doing so well in Baghdad. We were looking for Zarqawi, who was the head of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and we were not finding him. This guy was supposed to be tied to Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and I didn't feel like I was making a lot of progress, and this was a huge victory for me. And then years later, a colleague of mine at Langley mentioned that she had questioned him at a different detention facility. This was like 2 years later, and that he still hadn't confessed, and people were starting to think maybe we'd gotten the wrong guy. And it was like a moment of reckoning for me. I mean, it was a moment that kind of stopped me and still haunts me to this day. And you know, it's like, did I save a life, or did I really affect someone's life in a bad way? You know, I mean, I don't know. To this day, I don't know. And I think my book is, is about, in some ways, you know, it's about an aging spy caught in the crosswinds of the Arab Spring who makes these decisions that have sort of world-altering consequences, but aren't necessarily what he anticipated. So I think in a way, it was sort of me processing my own experiences in this world of espionage, where you make these decisions in a fog of war, a fog of spying, and you don't always know what the consequences will be.
And by the way, if you haven't gotten her book, you should. It's great.
Thank you.
And you'd sort of alluded to this, to your time in Baghdad and Bahrain, perhaps, as an expat. And I'll go back to my quick story I've said before. Tom Clancy spoke in the bubble when I was first there. And he said, as long as I write, you guys are going to be the heroes in my book.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, so my question is, given your characters and we were just talking about the PTSD and things were going good, did you frame your characters as good, bad, real?
Yeah.
You know, cliche, not quite cliche. How did you characterize them?
That's such a good question. I don't think any of my characters would be considered a hero. In fact, I think when I first signed with my agent, he said, oh, I love that you have all anti-heroes in your book. And I mean, so a lot of people have very strong reactions to my protagonist because he's not incredibly likable. And for me, I felt like A, that was more realistic, and B, it was more interesting that way. And I found when I look back at literature I love, the most interesting characters were always the mixed or unlikable ones. Theodore Dreiser in American Tragedy has a horribly unlikable protagonist, or The Sympathizer by Viet Thanh Nguyen has an unlikable protagonist. And I think that makes them more interesting and in a way even more sympathetic, because I think, I don't know, you look for kind of the good in them. And I mean, I think my protagonist, Shane Collins, I think he tries to do the right thing in his own way. And so for me, he's not a hero, but in a way he kind of is. And I tried to sort of pay homage to the people who are caught in this messy world. And they're not clear cut heroes, but they do their best and they try to do the right thing.
So I know that the three of us here have worked in this industry know that the reality to working in the industry is very, very slow, very gradual, and can be even boring at times, and very, very complex, unlike the kind of Hollywood glitz and glam. And I know you've tried to stray away from that. So what challenges were there when it comes to kind of putting this into book form to turn this into a novel that is based more on the reality of working in intelligence, more so? You know, the bang bang.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. I mean, I think that a lot of people expect spy novels to be shoot 'em up car chases, and that was not the kind of novel I wanted to write. So I think mine is, more of it's kind of quieter, more realistic spy novel. I mean, I think I didn't feel like I had to embellish much to make it exciting, because sometimes I feel like even the reality is more interesting to me than the theatrics. I mean, I think that it's sort of easy to use technology or lots of fireworks, I guess, to propel a plot. And in some ways, I think that more interesting plots are more psychological or cerebral. So they're not high drama plot, I guess. And so I set out to write an interesting spy novel based on sort of the psychological aspect of it, because I think at its essence, tradecraft is really psychological anyway. There were scenes here and there where I felt like I had to throw in a few theatrical gimmicks. Like there's a scene where Source uses invisible ink with lemon juice. And I get a lot of people who ask me, you guys use invisible ink at the CIA, right? And I'm like, no, I got that idea from my kid's science project.
Wild West had that.
Yeah,
it was a free gift at Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah.
Well, this is something all of you can answer, but I wonder, Alana, if the lifestyle, when you talked about at the very beginning about the manipulating and all that and the things that you went through and how it affected you and stuff, does that lifestyle ever go away? Like, can you ever break away from of thinking? And I mean this in the fact of things are going on in the world, and there's a lot of stuff now in public with problems and stuff. But whenever stuff happens, does it take you back to that time when you were in there, and do you react the same way?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that being in a profession where you're taught to distrust everyone and people kind of distrust you, I do think that makes you more cynical and maybe a little savvier as well. So I do think I look at the world with a kind of more jaundiced, cynical eye. And I think, you know, if you read my book, you can see that too, because it's like I said, it's a pretty dark book. And I think it does make me savvier. I mean, just recently, to give you an example, I had this horrible hoax played on me where I got a call from with an AI generated voice of my son's voice, but it was AI generated, and he was in distress. I don't know if you've heard about this hoax. I had not heard about it at the time, but anyhow, it was really horrifying, and it was my son's voice. And at the time, I had like sense in the middle of it to think of like kind of an op test to see if this was really my son, because it kind of was occurring to me that this was a hoax. So I said, you know, what's your birthday? And at that point, the person calling, who undoubtedly wanted money or something, hung up. But I do think, like, that's how you learn to think as a case officer, you know, is you learn to kind of game people and to come up with these tests and to assume that you're being manipulated. So I think it is part of my psyche, for better and for worse. But I'm curious what other people think.
How much have you taken with you now, not mentally, but sort of naturally automatic in your everyday life? And I'll give you my example. Mm-hmm. I've been out for a long time, and I do situational awareness, SDR, looking in my mirror, walking down the street and looking for people all the time.
Do you?
Constantly. I can't get away from it. In fact, I was on a Motorola trip long ago, and we were being followed by a thief. And I was saying, I told my guy I was with, we're being followed. He was like, oh my God, so just stay with me. And I ran an SDR and got this guy basically thrown out of a mall.
Oh my God.
But it's more an interesting story than that. I'm not the guest, but is there anything, and maybe Gavin too, is there anything that you just can't get away from? And did you implant that on your characters perhaps, since you built these characters?
I personally teach my daughter this. So when I can't get away from it, it's not just the fact that I can't get away from it. I'm teaching my daughter. We do an SDR on the way to school. So, you know, and the school's half a mile away, and it takes us like kind of 20 minutes. So
yeah.
I'm constantly teaching. We play the silly plate game where she sits in the car and she'll be like making up a word from the last three letters on the license plate of the vehicle behind. She needs to observe it without kind of making it obvious. And if the vehicle changes, you know, then we've got crazy games. We play for situational awareness and all sorts of things. So not only can I not get away from it personally, I'm instilling it into my daughter. So we go out for a meal and she instinctively knows where I want to sit in the restaurant. You know, she's looking at the exits and the cameras and the ways out and that kind of thing. So
is my wife. How about you, Alana? Are you there yet, or you're still a...
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think, you know, it's weird. I think I actually had the opposite experience in that. I think I kind of made a conscious break from that lifestyle after I left. I mean, I do remember, you know, for a while after leaving the agency, it was like Joe said, I mean, it's such a part of you, and you're kind of staring out of windows and you're looking in your mirror and you're looking behind your shoulder. And I mean, those habits die hard for sure. But I also think that it's such a burden. I mean, it really is. Like, that's one thing I don't miss about the agency. When you're there, you're always looking behind your shoulder. And it's like a weight. And I think at a certain point in my life, I was like, I left, I'm out, you know, I served my country and I'm incredibly proud of that. And I wouldn't trade it. But, you know, at a point in my life, I just felt like I want to let go of the weight. So I don't look in my mirrors. I mean, the skills are all there. But I try not to, be that, you know, that cautious and have that mindset.
Now you will. Now
you will.
Joe got me kicked out of the mall.
Yeah. Yeah. He looked just like you.
Yeah, it was me. I still do it, and I'm not even in the agency. So, did you, Ilana? Did you plan a meaning in this? Did you besides the story itself, the entertainment value and stuff? Was there something you wanted to get across to people when they read the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think I wanted to get across the nature of espionage, and I wanted to paint a really realistic, unvarnished picture, not the glamorous, sexy picture that is out there so often, and I love those kind of books. They're escapist and they're wonderful. But I just wanted to write as realistic a spy novel as I could. And I wanted to convey the toll it takes on you. I think wanted to make a point about the Middle East, you know, apropos of what's going on in the world, that I spent, you know, a year in Baghdad, 2 years in Bahrain. And, you know, the Middle East is such an interesting, complex, intricate place. And people, I think, don't understand it. I think they rush to judgment. I think there are so many layers to the Middle East, and there's so many layers to these conflicts. And I think American intervention in historically in various conflicts, not just in the Middle East, including in like Vietnam, for example, but has been kind of a minefield, you know. It's had unintended consequences, or in Iraq, for example. And I think I wanted to convey that feeling of sort of enter at your own risk. I mean, my book, I hope, conveys the complexity of the Arab Spring and how Western intervention can have really profound consequences, and perhaps not the consequences we intend.
Oh, so it's not like Joe told me. Joe told me that it was just like James Bond.
Yeah, exactly. Pay no attention to reality. Great character, though. He had his moment of time. Fortunately, George Smiley came along and sort of balanced it out.
Yeah, that's true.
So you actually that's true. That's why you did it. So, and you actually just said a word about sort of complexity. I wrote down the word nuance while you were talking. Arab Spring. There was so much, like you say, underneath it,
yeah.
The people and the politics and the forces behind it.
Yeah.
So my overall question is, did you start with the plot as your main point, or did you start with the characters, that main point, and they were interacting with that nuance in that plot?
I think I had in my mind that I wanted my main character to be caught between the two sides of the Arab Spring, and to think he's going in one direction, but then to slowly go in another direction. So I kind of knew where the beginning and the end would be. I didn't necessarily know exactly how to get there or what the middle would be. So I think I had the plot and I adjusted the characters. But at the same time, I did have very clear ideas of what I wanted the characters to look like. And a lot of it was influenced by The Quiet American by Graham Greene. I don't know if anyone's read that.
Classic.
Yeah. I mean,
classic.
My favorite book of all time, spy novel or otherwise.
Yep.
I just think it's like a masterpiece on a plane.
It's always in the top five.
Yeah. I mean, it's so terrific. And I took so much of my book, in a way, was sort of a modern reimagining of The Quiet American, because it's, you know, Vietnam, the book is about, you know, this aging British journalist who doggedly remains neutral, who says he's not going to step off the sidelines until, of course, his young rival, Alden Pyle, takes his lover. And, but there's the whole geopolitical context of getting involved in Vietnam. And I mean, many say that book is sort of the quintessential cautionary tale against involvement and entanglement. And I thought, gosh, you know, the Arab Spring in so many ways is like a modern analog of Vietnam in that way. And so I kind of modeled my characters after The Quiet American. I have the aging spy. He's not a journalist, but he is basically vying with this young rival who's kind of the face of American optimism and naivete, just like in The Quiet American. And in fact, my my character, the station chief, his name is Whitney Alden Mitchell, and his middle name, Alden, I took from the name of the character in The Quiet American, the CIA author named Alden. So sort of a nod to Graham Greene.
Ah, I didn't catch it. I'm an idiot.
Yeah, that's okay. Nobody does. That's fine.
No, yeah, I am. I'm an idiot. Yeah,
I was just leaving that. That was sounding good. That was sounding
you
good.
You beat Gavin to the punch. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, so now that you've completed the book, and you look back at it and it's out and everything, do you think that it's affected you in some way? Have you gained some sort of knowledge or changed in somewhat after going through the experience of writing this book?
Yeah, I think that it definitely, it's kind of like a form of therapy. I think it's helped to understand my experiences. I mean, I don't think I had in my mind when I started off the book, oh, I'm really haunted by that operation in Baghdad where I might have helped to detain an innocent man. I don't think I was thinking that at the beginning of the book, but I think by the end I was. So I think, you know, it helped me sort of come to terms with my own issues and my own ghosts. I think that am I all the better for it? Probably not, because I think, I don't know. I think, you know, when you have things like, I think it's a work in progress. I think that it helps you to deal with these things. I think that, but it's something you have to continue to do. So, I mean, it's something that still haunts me is I guess my point, but I'm more self-aware.
Just smoke your meat on the barbecue and you'll yeah. become better.
That's aimed at me. So you leave that alone. All right. Don't humor him. Don't give him a chance. Just walk away.
When you were at the DOD, was it something that you had intentions straight away of going transition to the CIA, or was that something that was it an opportunity? Was it a talent spot? Tell us about the transition there.
Yeah, so I actually was enrolled in law school right after college, and then I had like a panic attack because I was like, I don't know if I want to practice law. So I deferred my entry for 2 years and went overseas to work for DOD as an intelligence analyst, and I loved that job. To this day, that's probably one of my favorite jobs. I felt like I was serving the military, I was serving alongside these amazing, heroic men and women, and I just loved it. And I got to use my brain to analyze issues. At the time, it was the Balkans were the big issue. I would go back and forth. I was stationed near Cambridge, England, and I would go back and forth to the Balkans, and it was so interesting. And then I deferred for 2 years, and I intended just to go back to law school after that, to start law school after that. And I remember somebody, I worked with a lot of different intel types when I was working for the Department of Defense, and including the CIA. And I remember one guy, he was a military guy, and he said, you know, you might want to consider applying to the CIA. You know, they could use more women. And it kind of was like, oh, huh, okay. You know, and because I loved my job so much, and I thought, wow, you know, to be a case officer, it's a similar job, but I'm really in the trenches as a case officer, and I'm overseas, and it's exciting. And I thought, okay, so maybe I'll do that. So I applied to the CIA, but back then it was a glacial process. It took over 2 years. So then I went to law school while I was waiting for my application to process, and then I started at the agency. And never practiced law until after I left.
Which is what you're doing now, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, in theory, I practiced law for a few years after I left the agency. And then, and it was national security law. But then I got married and had my son. And then we moved to Bahrain when my son was a toddler. And it was hard to practice law from Bahrain. So then I started writing my book when I got back and thought, you know, I think writing is a better fit than practicing law. So I kind of took a step back.
Yeah, I don't blame you, you know. So what are you going to go on to next? Are you going to do this then more regular? Are you going to have more books?
I hope so. I've started on my second book, and, you know, funny enough, it's about that operation I described. It's based on that operation I described in Baghdad, where we helped to apprehend perhaps the wrong guy and sort of the avalanche of consequences that follows. But I do feel like I would love to write a book about the experience of a female case officer, a counterterrorist case officer in wartime Baghdad, because I feel like that's sort of an underrepresented experience. You know, it's not there's not a lot out there about that. So, but I welcome any suggestions if anyone has any.
Write another great book. That's only pressure. Write another great book.
Oh, well, thanks.
Well, that was actually my question is what impact, your book has had a lot of success, best book of the year lists and things. What impact has that or will, do you think will have on, as you write your second book, do you feel the pressure of the readers over your shoulder thinking about, oh, I gotta satisfy them? Or are they just not there at all?
Yeah, it's such a good question. A little bit, I do. And I didn't anticipate that because I've never been that kind of writer. I mean, I just write the best thing I can. But what's weird is that the number one question I get is why I wrote a male protagonist. I mean, that really, I think, that really throws people. And the reason I did, by the way, is A, I really needed kind of a typical case officer, someone who'd been in the business for, you know, 20 some years. And that's really just more typically male. That's the reality. And number two was that a female operating in the Middle East would face a whole host of constraints and limitations that a man wouldn't. And that would have been my story then. It would have been a totally different story and not really the one I wanted to tell. So that's why I had a male protagonist. But a lot of people are thrown by the fact that I'm a female writing a male protagonist. And it has given me pause. I mean, I think my next book, I was going to have a female protagonist regardless, but it almost seems a necessity now because so many people have asked, you know, oh, you really should write a female protagonist. And also I think, when you read my book, you see that I'm kind of a descriptive writer. I mean, I write a lot of details and for me, that's just my writing style. And also I really wanted to make time and place a character in the book. Like I wanted Bahrain to be a character in the book because to me it was as interesting and evolving and changing as a human. And the best way for me to do that was to write really descriptively about Bahrain. And some people love it. Most people, I would say, love it. But then some people don't. Some people think, oh, it's too many words, or I just want, you know, like he did this, he did that, you know, just kind of bare bones. And I do find myself kind of thinking more about my writing style, like, oh, maybe I should adjust it based on what people have said. So I don't know. I haven't figured it all out. I mean, do you all have thoughts on that? I mean, how has it been for you guys?
Well, if you ask me, I don't do your style, but I would say keep going like you're going. I think that the location is very important, and so you write it as a character. So Bahrain has to be, you have to describe it. And if someone doesn't get that, I think it has too much effect on your story, right? Too much not to do it. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, who am I? I'm just a radio guy. So
writing male female, write the female character, you know. Put yourself in their shoes, because you're talking to a bunch of people who may want to be that, right? You may be influencing them, saying, "Ah, this is an interesting. I want like you did. I want to be a case officer. I'm in the trenches.
Mm-hmm.
There's somebody like them who's there. You've been there, so that might be.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to talk about the grand scheme, that might be something. But I think you'll also enjoy that character because you'll just see yourself and your friends, you know, and the limitations and advantages. Because when I was there, the women were just like, forget it. Weren't that many?
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, to write it, because you said, you know, you had the beginning, and just sit down and write your, you know, first, best, worst sentence and let it rip, right?
Yeah. I mean, for all my thoughts on, oh, maybe I should, you know, change this or change that, at the end of the day, I think, you know, you are who you are as a writer, you know, and I think when it comes out, it's kind of like your personality. I mean, you can only change your personality so much. It's still who you are. So, you know, I think it's taken me a lifetime to find my voice, but here it is. And
use that voice.
I think it's there for better or worse. So, yeah.
You tell them Shane used to be a woman.
That's a very interesting idea.
It was a good show. Yeah.
Well, but, you know, that solves that problem and say, well, Shane is a female character. What are you talking about?
Yeah, that would be okay.
Yeah. And then they'll go, oh, okay. And say, yeah. Well, you'll find out more about that in book two. You see, and then you'll be selling lots of book twos.
Right.
I tell you, you just need me as your agent, right? Yeah, I'll work it out for you. Don't worry about it.
Great idea.
I'm groaning.
How was it getting in the head of your main character, Shane Collins, then? Like, how did you arrive at that place?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. And, you know, it was not that hard, to be honest. I mean, because he's not a lot like me. But I don't know. I just felt like I would sit down at this local Starbucks every day, and I would just think to myself, okay, I am Shane Collins. Like, what am I going to say? Sometimes I'm a jerk, you know. Sometimes I want to say something nasty to someone, and occasionally I would find my. I mean, he's not,
just getting kicked out of Starbucks.
And I mean, occasionally I'd find myself writing a sentence that I felt was too bland. Like, it sounded like me, or it sounded like a neutral narrator, right? And then I would stop. I mean, I really went over every sentence in my book with sort of a fine tooth comb. And I was like, would Shane Collins say that, you know, or would he say something that, like, or would he be more of a dick, you know, like, and usually the answer was the latter. And so I would really go through and think, what, you know, I'm Shane Collins. What's coming out of my mouth? And I also had the whole backstory in my mind. I mean, you learn a little about his childhood. He was abused as a child, and his parents were alcoholics, and he is an alcoholic. And to me, that made him more sympathetic. And I kind of kept that in my mind too. Like, this is a guy who's damaged, who carries a lot of baggage, and that affects his decisions. And but there's good in him too.
Brilliant. So with that in mind, what would you say to anybody who wants to come and look at a career in intelligence now? And what would your advice to them be?
I would say go for it. I mean, I think it's such a noble profession. I mean, I think you make a lot of sacrifices doing it, but I think it's certainly a necessary service. And I think the agency has really changed for the better over the years. You know, when I was there, this was before the Me Too movement, and women weren't always treated well. And I've seen almost like a sea change, just from the outside, at least. I've seen a big change in the agency. There's been a lot of accountability. The agency had its first female director. They're having hearings now, I think, on Capitol Hill about sexual harassment. So I think it's a friendlier environment for women than it used to be. And I think it's just a more accountable organization than it used to be. So at the end of the day, it was, you know, it had its good and bad moments, but at the end of the day, it was a good experience for me, and I would recommend it.
And you've sort of answered this question, but I think I'm asked a different way in simple terms. Why write? Why does Alana write?
Oh, well, it's what I've always done. Even when I was a kid, I think that was my way of dealing with anything. I would keep voluminous journals. I remember my mom would sneak into my room and read them. And I was so angry because I kept my life in these journals. And when I was in my
boo room, mom, boo mom.
I know, right? I'll tell her not to listen to this. But when I was in my 20s, I backpacked around Europe, and I remember, I kept voluminous travel journals. I would record everything that I saw. It was my way of understanding these countries and their culture and their history. I still have all those travel journals. And every now and then, I mean, I wrote so much. Every now and then, like, I would find myself, right when I wrote The Peacock and the Sparrow, I would find an old sentence I'd written from my travels or wherever, like, creeping out into my manuscript that I'd written, you know, 20 years ago or something. And so I think it was just my way. I used to write like angst-ridden poems when I was a teenager. I mean, they're so bad, like just so bad. I can't even read them now. But it was always my kind of go-to mechanism for making sense of my experiences. I had a teacher in my seventh grade English teacher who was wonderful and supportive, and she's actually in my acknowledgement. She always encouraged me to be a writer, but I would write such like dark and angst-ridden poems that one time she asked me to stay after school, and she was like, "Are you okay? Like, what's wrong with you?" And it really, I was totally fine. I mean, I was like a normal, you know, teenage girl just dealing with teenage things. But yeah, it always came out in my writing.
And you don't like those poems, hey? So we've got some of them here. We're going to read them.
Oh, great. Wonderful.
No, just kidding. Well, now, are you available on social media for people? Do you have a website? How do you like readers to find you?
Oh, yeah. All of the above. I have a website, isberry.net, and I am isberry author on both Twitter and Instagram and Threads, if anyone's on Threads. Not many people are, but yeah.
No, not very many yet, but yeah. They're there.
So, yeah.
Well, fantastic. Oh, okay, so we'll have all of that up on our website and
great.
Along with your book. And the book is The Peacock and the Sparrow. It's a novel. I.S. Berry is the author and our guest. So thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.